Chatter on Books. It's Cliff Notes for book clubs. Why read the book if you can listen to Chatter on Books? I'm Jamie McIntyre, your announcer. But you don't care about that. Here again is your host, Tori Clark.
Welcome back to Chatter on Books. Hope you're doing well. Hope you're staying healthy. Thank you for listening. In just a little bit, we're going to be talking to Lisa Gardner, who's been on Chatter before, about One Step Too Far. And I have 9 million things I want to ask Lisa, but every time I thought I had this one figured out. AP has rightfully called Lisa one of the best psychological thriller writers out there, and it's true. Every time I thought I had it figured out, I was wrong. So I have so many questions. It's a great book. And with us tonight, we've got Claude doing all the important work. Claude, who was too busy to watch the most fabulous football weekend ever.
Too sleepy.
David Aldridge, of course, and our favorite mayor, Mayor Judd Ashman from Gaithersburg and the founder of the Gaithersburg Book Festival. Judd, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Last time I saw you, Judd, was on the sidelines of a curling rink. Did you recover?
Can I just say to everybody who's listening to this, if you get invited to a party that Tori is throwing, you need to go.
Go.
There was curling at her house. It was quite amazing.
Yeah. And it got much more competitive than we ever thought it would. So memo to file on that. Okay. We've got a few things. First of all, I've got two of my favorite people in the world. David, you know Billie Jean King, right?
Yes. I don't know her personally, but yes.
But I know. Okay. But yes, so one of my all-time favorite people, next to Dolly Parton, who was a goddess, and Billie Jean King, who's very big on social media, recently tweeted out, Dolly Parton donated $1 million to help develop the Moderna COVID vaccine and her Dolly's Library program, a book gifting program that mails free, high-quality books to children from birth to age 5, has gifted over 172 million books. Thank you, Dolly Parton, for being you. So thank you, Billie Jean King and Dolly Parton. Before I die, we're going to get Dolly Parton on the show.
Oh,
That'd be the best, right? We could just split.
I would be a puddle for 45 minutes. It would be really embarrassing for me. I would just not do well.
You know, we've probably said this on the show. You know what she calls her boobs? Which I think I can say that. Shock and awe. So great. I am going to Gulfport, Mississippi next month. And on my way back, I will make my almost annual pilgrimage to Dollywood, which is great.
Yes.
Okay, David first, and Judd, I promise we're going to talk about the Gaithersburg Book Festival, because it's one of the most fun things I did last year. I want to hear about what the plans are for this year. But David, in your professional opinion, was it the best football weekend ever?
It's hard to find one that's better, that was better. I mean, when you talk about all four games going down to the last play, literally. Yeah. Three teams winning on the road on kicks at the gun at the end. Just incredible drama, theater. And what made it great, Tori, was, and this is sadly the dilemma facing the local football team, is that you had 8 teams with 8 quarterbacks, right? And so if you looked at all 8 quarterbacks, you know, you had Aaron Rodgers, you had Tom Brady, you had Mahomes, you had Allen, you had Joe Burrow, you had Jimmy Garoppolo. You know, you had these, all these quarterbacks, 6 or 7 of whom were outstanding. The worst of the group by far was Ryan Tannehill. He threw 3 interceptions. He was awful. Washington would kill to have Ryan Tannehill on their team right now. Like, they'd give up 4 first round picks to have Ryan Tannehill on their team. That just tells you how far back they are in the firmament of the National Football League right now.
As someone who's not paid a whole lot of attention to the NFL this year, because I just have very mixed feelings about my beloved Steelers these days, and Ben Roethlisberger, time to move on. But I started watching at the very end, of course. And I was telling you guys before the show, I stopped doing everything I was supposed to be doing this weekend because I got addicted to these games.
Compelling.
And one of the things I used to always say when Brady was good, they didn't make it, but Brady was good. But I used to always say, you know, the only team where if there's a minute left or a minute 30 and they're down by 14, well, if Brady's the quarterback, no, they could still win. And I kept saying in these games this weekend, well, if Brady were the quarterback, then they could make up this gap. And then whoever the quarterback was made up the gap.
Yeah.
Judd, I saw you tweeting about it this weekend.
It was riveting. It was like kind of like a Lisa Gardner book. I mean, you just couldn't turn away. You get started and you just got to see it through to the end. No, honestly, I've been watching football for 40 years at this point, and I've never seen a weekend like this. This was spectacular. It was like a a great statement by the NFL for the product that they're putting forward. A little bit of funny schadenfreude about Aaron Rodgers on Twitter after that loss. I have to admit, I did get some chuckles out of that, but it was wonderful.
David, how do professionals feel about Aaron Rodgers these days?
Me?
Yeah.
he's an amazingly talented quarterback. He really is. He's probably the best quarterback in football.
Really? Probably the best quarterback in football?
Yeah, I think still. I think he makes throws that nobody else can make. He just does. He's that good. But, you know, it gets back into with the great talent comes, I think, great responsibility. With the privilege comes great responsibility.
Like it
and
or not.
I don't think he's being responsible.
Yeah.
I just don't think he's being a responsible person with the attention that he gets for being a great quarterback. And I say that as somebody who has watched every, and I'm not kidding, because my wife's from Wisconsin. She's 40 minutes north of Milwaukee. We've watched every Packers game probably the last 25 years, going back to Brett Favre.
Wow.
And it's a Packer household. My son was devastated when they lost the other night. We love the Packers here. And it's very odd to root for a team whose quarterback says things that you just go, what are you talking about? Like this is insane what you're saying. That has nothing to do with him as a quarterback. He is a great quarterback. Yeah.
No, I talked to two diehard Packers fans, one in Minneapolis yesterday, and both of them said, they hate to lose, but Rodgers being such a jerk kind of made it better. It made it easier. It made it easier to accept the loss.
Yeah. Okay. Tough.
Yeah.
Tough.
Okay. All right. Should we pretend to talk about books? Let's do that. So Judd, last year I got to be a part of virtually of the Gaithersburg Book Festival, which is one of the biggest and best book festivals in the country. It was great. And got to meet Maroa Yejide, about whom David and I fight all the time, who loves her more.
She's wonderful.
What are the plans for this year? Where we're kind of still in COVID, kind of not. What are the plans?
We are proceeding as if it will be in person again. We are tired of doing virtual events. It will be Saturday, May 21st, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. It will be free to attend and free to park, which I don't think you can say that about anything in D.C. Never free to park.
No.
In terms of health and safety, I mean, the first thing is our festival's outdoors. So we have that sort of advantage there.
Sure.
We'll be following whatever the best protocols are in terms of masking requirements and spacing the chairs out. And we're going to figure it out. But that is our goal. That's what we're planning. And we hope that you guys will come and do something at the festival. We got to discuss that offline, I suppose.
If there's free beer, we'll be there. You know, we're cheap.
I'm sure we can make that happen.
We're easy. Okay. Now I have to ask you guys this, and I promise, Lisa, we will get to you quickly. But it seems like every few months in the show, we find ourselves with another instance of somebody banning books. Might be a school. It might be a school board. And this time I saw this piece. I think I found it in the Washington Post, an op-ed about certain prisons and prison systems banning certain books. And I personally think, and David, you remember Chris Wilson we had on the show, who wrote The Master Plan, amazing guy, how important books must be to prisoners. And there are prisons that are banning books, specifically banning books like Malcolm X, specifically banning The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison, specifically banning The New Jim Crow, which is one of the best books ever written. And I just want to ask both of you guys, am I being an idiot to be surprised by this?
No, and I'm not an idiot, but you can't be surprised by this. I just don't know how you could be surprised by this type of behavior in the current political climate. You mentioned Chris Wilson, and you remember in the book he talked about they had the Book Crushers Club, right?
Right.
A bunch of guys who were in prison who started reading books together, and it became central to him developing not only intellectually, but finding his voice as a human being. You know, who am I? I think was a big part of why he wound up in prison. Didn't know who he was. He found out who he was. And I certainly, there's no way you can't even put a price on how important reading was to me as a kid, how important it was for me to walk up to the library every Saturday. And I do mean every Saturday, and check out two or three books to read.
Right.
And it just completely broadens your worldview. I mean, it opens up the world to you. And the only reason that you would deny people to do that is because you don't want them to have an open worldview. You don't want them to be critical thinkers.
Yeah.
And that's just so it's inhumane.
One of the things that I keep saying they, so it was written by Andy Chan and Michelle Dillon, who are on the board of a nonprofit called Books and Prisoners. It's been going on since the 1970s. They provide free books to prisoners, an amazing group. And one of the things they cited was in 2020, some of the researchers found that a Wisconsin correctional facility, allowed Mein Kampf into the prisons. Okay. But banned publications about the Black Panthers because they said that was about gang activity. It's just insane. But Judd, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't think any of us want prison guards to be put in a position of like determining literary merit, right? Mm-hmm. But there is, to be fair, there is an imperative for, I guess, for people who run prisons that they maintain order. And so if, for example, there's a book whose purpose is like to directly cause disruption and violence, like, you know, How to Escape Prison for Dummies, or, you know, 99 practical jokes to play on your corrections officers or something like that, I can say, okay, right, it's reasonable to ban it. But otherwise, I agree entirely with what David said. I mean, books, almost regardless of what the content of the book is, it's exercising a muscle that I think isn't as much superficially telling you what to think as it is teaching you how to think about things, how to think independently. And I think that's, if we believe in redemption, if we believe in people, humanity, then I think we should be as liberal, small L liberal, as possible in what books we allow in prison.
Yep. Agree completely. And I think we've talked about this in the show before, and maybe in the context of young people, but it holds true for people incarcerated as well. Books are a safe place to wrestle with big issues. And to David, to your point, to find out who someone is, it's a safe way to do that. So
absolutely,
very few downsides to this. So kind of a depressing topic. So now, yeah, we're going to move on. We're going to move on to Lisa, who's been putting up with our sports talk, our banning books talk. Lisa Gardner, welcome back to Chatter on Books.
Thank you very much. You know, I wrote 4 books with prison break scenes, and I actually get a lot of mail, including a prisoner who wanted to know my references. So maybe my book will be banned next. I don't know.
What kinds of things do they write about? What do they say? They just say, we loved your book. And
a lot of them want to talk about their life story. I did get a marriage proposal. So, nice. I mean, it's eclectic.
I assume he include a picture?
No, but he wanted a new photo of me. I passed.
Many years ago, when I worked for John McCain, he was running for Senate, and he got this very nice letter. I don't know why it was handed to me to respond to, but this very nice letter from a guy who, we had all the different groups, you know, environmentalists for McCain and Vietnam vets for McCain, all the usual constituencies. And this guy, God bless him, he's in prison in Flagstaff or somewhere, and he wanted to start Prisoners for McCain. And he was an incredible artist. He had drawn these pictures of what the tattoos would look like and all these other things. And he had a logo and things like that. And I was the one that had to write the letter back to him saying, thanks very much. Unfortunately, you're not allowed to vote. So we had to turn him down. Very sad. Okay. But Lisa, so many books, so many wonderful books. And I read a little bit in your acknowledgments about this, but tell us how the last year and a half, the pandemic has affected your writing, and specifically this book. And we will talk a lot about One Step Too Far and mention it many times because then people will buy it.
Oh, thank you very much, Tori. So it's interesting for me. I think like a lot of people in lockdown, you know, you just want to be outside. You want to dream bigger. You want the wide open spaces. I am an avid hiker already, but during the pandemic, I became a more like an obsessed hiker. Uh-huh. And just, you know, we're spending so much time indoors. I really wanted to set a thriller outside, partly so I could be outside. And then I read an article really of a very true issue in the United States, which is the number of people that go missing on national public lands. And there's no one even looking for them. They fall through the cracks, 1600 people. It's one of those things, if you disappear in the woods, you know, all the volunteers, park services, everyone's trying in the short term, but 2-3 weeks, months later, everyone has to go back to their lives. And these people are just gone.
So is it 1600 a year?
1600 total at this time.
Oh, okay. All right, that's a lot.
So, yeah, and well, and for those families, there's this closure. And so Frankie Elkin, who's my character, who likes to solve missing persons cold cases, I mean, her mission really is closure for the families. And if you're someone who's, my son went for a hike and then that's it, or my, you know, four-year-old wandered away from a campfire, that not knowing is so hard. And it just became this perfect, you know, setup for a book. To be outside, to bring back Frankie Elkin, which so many people loved from before she disappeared. And then I set it in Wyoming because, you know, big, big mountains, glaciers, wide open spaces, and let me live there in my head during the pandemic. And that was the place to be.
Even though you couldn't go there. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I remember you like to go to the places that are in your books and live it and breathe it and feel it. And this, in this case, you couldn't. Correct.
You know, the hard part for One Step Too Far was I couldn't go specifically to where I wanted to go in Wyoming. I am a big hiker, so that helped. And I come from actually out west, because where I live now in New England, the mountains are different. For one, they're a lot smaller. But that helped. But now I'm looking forward to going to Wyoming, because now I have to hike all these places I've been studying and reading and longing for.
I like to think that I do love the outdoors. I love to hike. My husband and I hike all the time. And after reading this book, I'm like, that might not be such a good idea. Some of our more adventuresome, you know, ideas, we kind of go, that might not be so smart. We might be way in over our heads. Give us the thumbnail sketch of One Step Too Far, because people who follow the show and follow you, Frankie, this incredible woman with lots of issues of her own, goes and finds people who are missing and nobody else tries to find. But give us the thumbnail sketch of why Frankie headed to Wyoming.
Oh, so perfect. So this young man 5 years ago went missing in the deep Wyoming wilderness on a bachelor party weekend. Disappeared in the middle of the night, never been seen since. His mother is now dying of cancer, and her dying wish is to be buried next to her son. So, and this actually follows kind of the real life process for these things. The father on his own is launching one last search attempt. And he's kind of assembled this dream team. So it's himself, it's a guide. It's the three friends who are with his son who are guilt stricken. You have a search dog, a cadaver dog, which is one of my favorite things to research.
Yes.
You have a Bigfoot hunter, which will come back later. And you have Frankie Elkin. And it's eight people heading to the woods. And I pretty much talk about it as Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None. Goes for a hike.
And Judd, jump in here anytime, because I know you read a lot of these books. But Frankie, in my opinion, is really good in cities. And she's really good where she can be where people have lived and worked and related to one another. And she gets her strength, if you will, from understanding what people are doing and how they're doing it together. This is a very different environment for her. What made you think about doing that, putting her in such an unnatural setting for her?
Yeah, I mean, and that was kind of the fun. Because when we last saw Frankie, you're right. She's in urban Boston inner city trying to find a missing Haitian immigrant. And now she's in the deep woods of Wyoming. And, you know, if you're working a cold case, generally your strength as the outsider coming in is talking to people. You interview the neighbors, witnesses, the family. And maybe now that time has passed and the fact that, you know, she's not a police officer, they'll speak. Well, there's none of that when you're doing a search in the woods. I mean, other than interviewing grizzly bears, I mean, Frankie really struggles with this. I mean, it seemed like such a good idea when she joined this. And then she's on the first hiking trail kind of going, oh, wait a minute, this might not have been my best idea.
So I'm actually really glad she knew nothing about hiking or very little, because I, you know, I'd like to think I like hiking, but in terms of what I learned as Frankie was learning it, it was pretty substantial. I think people will really enjoy that. But I wanted to ask you about this whole book, Bigfoot search culture, because I remember hearing about Bigfoot a lot when I was young, but I hadn't heard about Bigfoot in some time. Is that still around? What's going on with Bigfoot?
Yeah, so Bigfoot came up as one of the very first things I discovered when I started researching this phenomenon of these cold cases. Is one of the first thing that comes up is there's no nationwide database. These people are somewhat falling through the cracks because we're not even tracking them. But into that gap is the North American Bigfoot, I think it's association, I can't quite remember now. They're active, they're out in the woods. They are actually involved right now, currently, in a mapping process of the United States, and in particularly certain regions like the Olympic Peninsula, which they feel is probably more likely the area Bigfoot's in. They know those mountains like the back of their hands. And there's many missing persons cases, hikers and whatnot. They're not only worked actively when they first disappeared, when they're out in those woods, they're still looking for them. So they're this actually incredible resource, which that's the thing I didn't know. And thanks to that, we have Bigfoot Bob, who's one of my favorite characters.
Great character.
So many wonderful characters. Tell us about Frankie's initial pod. It changes. And I got to be really careful not to give too much away. But again, Lisa, God, every 10 pages, I went, okay, I got this, right? Like, nope, wrong. But tell us about her initial pod, about Luciana and Daisy, probably my favorite creature in the whole book. And Bob, because initially they seem to be the ones that would be together and making it happen. And then it changes. But tell us about them and who would play them in the Netflix series.
So this is fun. I think one of the things I like about writing the Frankie Elkin books is, one, she's us. You know, she's not an investigator, FBI, law enforcement, right, formal military. She has no special skills. So she almost harkens back to the more traditional old-fashioned 1950s investigators, where it's social engineering. She's using her people skills and that she's empathetic and she gets people to talk. So it was fun to not only put her in the woods. Here's this woman that, you know, is always on her own in the middle of this group that she pretty quickly summarizes. This is a group that's not a group. Mm-hmm. I mean, like the three bachelor dudes are guilt stricken and in their own little world. The father and the wilderness guide are like their own like stoic robotic hiker, super hiker guys. And it leaves her and, you know, the quasi professional, she calls them. I mean, yeah, she has found missing people. Bigfoot Bob, who has a lot of outdoor experience and again, knows what he's doing. And then Luciana and the cadaver dog, the search and rescue dog, Daisy, who've definitely done this thing many times. And she leans very heavily on them because she has no idea what she's doing. She doesn't even know how to set up a tent. And right, those bonds and how Frankie Willis adapts to what she doesn't know, but actually starts making connections when she is a woman who is not known for connections.
Right. Okay, I have to ask you, tell us about Daisy and talk about the research you did on cadaver dogs, which sounds terrible and awful and gruesome, and it is, but it's also remarkable what the dogs do.
So I was very fortunate a number of years ago to go to the Body Farm in Knoxville, Tennessee. Uh-huh. And I was researching a different novel, and sheer serendipity, there was a search and rescue team there. And they were full, I can't remember quite the term, but they were full on search and rescue, as in the dogs were trained to do live, dead, and water searches. Mm-hmm. And it all at the same time. So depending on the circumstances, like, you know, when we're working a rubble pile, so they're flown all over the world doing right, natural disasters. And they were at the Body Farm to do some training themselves. And just talking to them and learning the dogs, the training that goes into it, the psychology of the dogs. I mean, one of them had taken a dog to Ground Zero and talked about the dog grew depressed.
Yes. Yeah.
Only finding human remains, it actually does get to them. And so one of the things they'll have volunteers do is a living person will hide at the end of the day so the dog can end on a good note. Yeah. I'm very passionate for dogs and all of that stuff I love. And I think Daisy's just amazing.
I tell too many stories, but I have to tell the story. So I was at the Pentagon on 9/11. It was awful and terrible. And there were many, many months in which they were trying to get remains and identify people who were killed at the Pentagon. And the families, this incredible group of families of those who were injured and died, set up essentially base camp for them was at the Key Marriott there at the end of the Key Bridge. And there were meetings all the time. And we worked with them all the time about many things. And therapy dogs came in and were an incredibly valuable part of the 6-12 months that they were going through this. And so one year after 9/11 in 2002, we had the first big memorial ceremony at the Pentagon. So many stupid things happened at the Pentagon. And a couple of days before, somebody who was putting on, creating all the logistics of the service and the memorial came to me and said this, that, and the other, and said, we've got a problem because the families say they want to have the therapy dogs there with them. And I said, of course. You know, some knucklehead with rule 2006-1463 said no non-Pentagon reservation. And I said, stop it. The therapy dogs will be there. So we get to the ceremony. It's the day was almost as beautiful as 9/11 was. And everybody is spread out, as you can imagine. And there are thousands of people in this incredible section with the families. And the therapy dogs are right next to them. And I've been working at the Pentagon nonstop for years, as many, many people were. And never really had the big emotional reaction to what had happened. That's the setup for this. So we're going through the ceremony, people are speaking, there's some music, and it's all fine. And I'm doing fine, and I'm making sure things are happening. I'm standing on the edge of the crowd. They played Battle Hymn of the Republic. And I just happened to look over at this point, and one of the therapy dogs puts his head up and howls.
Oh, gee.
Howls straight to the sky. And I completely lost it. Completely lost it. Broke down. Luckily happened to be standing next to the only guy on the planet who still carries a handkerchief, Larry Derrida. And he gave me the handkerchief. But these dogs are incredible. What they do in finding people alive, dead, and what they do to help the people that are going through the thing. So I'm so glad that Daisy got to have a big part in the book. Who's your favorite person in the book besides Frankie?
Oh, probably Daisy. It really is all about her too. I mean, that was the interesting thing when I was at the body farm and you talked to the forensic anthropologists. Like, for all the technology, all the toys we have, there's still nothing as good as a dog's nose. Yeah. And so the whole search team going in the woods, I mean, they're like the humans. I mean, they're there to assist Daisy. She is the star of the search.
Make sure that she can work. Yeah, it's pretty incredible. Okay, so much. Frankie is so obsessive. She's so obsessive. And in this story, in the wilds of Wyoming, I've spent some time out there. It can be really scary. She can't use that. It can't just be, I'm going to work harder. She has to. So was this very different for you writing about Frankie? Did you have to kind of put a new head on her to deal with what she was dealing with out in Wyoming?
What I like about Frankie is I think one of her superpowers is she's highly adaptable. It's not easy. She struggles with it. And she talks about, I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm a fish out of water. You know, my mind's racing. And I can't, you know, work or move to yet another city. You know, I'm stuck here in the woods. But there's kind of this ongoing theme in the novel between Nemeth, who is like the legendary wilderness guide, you know, survival of the fittest. And Frankie much more, is it? Because, you know, she's not the fittest.
Yeah,
she's suffering.
Like all of us. Okay. David first and then Judd. David, big part of what Frankie does in this book is putting herself in a completely uncomfortable, like totally out of her comfort zone.
Sure.
Totally out of her comfort zone. You've covered so many sports, so many individuals in sports, but what's the most uncomfortable situation in which you had to inject yourself? Professional
Greco-Roman wrestling at the 1992 Summer Olympics.
Oh man, who did you piss off to get that assignment?
Oh, that's the Olympics. That's the deal. I was at the Post at the time, and when you go to the Olympics, there's two things that you do. You work 18 to 20 hours a day, and you cover whatever they tell you to cover. And it doesn't matter if you've never covered it before, because everybody's covering stuff they've never covered before. You just go and you do the best you can, and it was so much fun. It was such a hoot to cover something I had no idea what the scoring was. I didn't even know how you got points. I didn't care. And you just do the best you can, and you figure out enough to write something that sort of sounds like an actual news story. But it was great. And I highly recommend it to everybody. Do things that you're not comfortable doing. It makes you better at everything.
My dad used to say, do something once a day that just terrifies you, which I do too much of that. Okay, Judd, mayor of a very large city, city in the DMV. What's the most uncomfortable? Maybe it's the pandemic, but I don't want to put words in your mouth.
That is my answer. I mean, I like David's story because he chose to do it. And I chose to be mayor, to be sure. none of us saw the pandemic coming. And, you know, just sort of fudging it from day to day, trying to make the best decisions you can about what's safe for our staff, for our residents, you know, policy wise, it's been wild and crazy. I think it's come out generally well for the city of Gaithersburg, which, Lisa, if you're not familiar, we're a suburb of Washington, D.C., in the state of Maryland. We're the third largest city at 70,000. Maryland's a state with Baltimore and a bunch of small cities. And so that's been really wild. But Tori, if you don't mind, I want to ask Lisa a question. And just say, first off, the book was propulsive. It's a page turner. It's like a masterclass in suspense. I really enjoyed it. So my question is, with this series, you are showing you're clearly interested enough in the theory of missing people and finding the missing that, you know, who may be all around us, that, you know, the, and obviously mm-hmm. the first Frankie book did really well. Congratulations. It's great. What do you think, what do you like about that theme in this day of time? And why do you think it resonates with readers so much right now?
It's interesting to me. I have been a novelist now, a crime fiction novelist for 30 years. When I first started out, it was all, you know, all serial killers all the time. Mm-hmm. And then we rolled into domestic suspense, which was basically still somewhat serial killers, but you were sleeping with them. And now, interesting enough, our next phase seems to be cold cases. And I think some of that is because we've had a lot of changes in technology. Now with DNA evidence, I mean, the hot thing from the past couple of years has been, you know, familial genealogy and DNA and what that can bring to it. But I think the other thing that's becoming interesting when you look at cold cases is this is an opportunity where and kind of an everyday person can make a difference. Hmm. There are people who are forming clubs in their own living rooms to work cold cases. I mean, honestly, Frankie's inspired by some real world things. Mm-hmm. And I kind of like it because it's almost the opposite of all the forensics and technology. And, you know, she's not a hacker. The answer isn't one Google search away or anything like that. We get back to more, I think, also the basics of investigative. It's the right person asking the right questions at the right time. Mm-hmm. And I think all of us want to believe maybe we could be that person. Mm-hmm. I think for a reader, you get more engaged because nice. She doesn't have any superpowers. You think, I mean, I could do this. Maybe not hiking in Wyoming, but I could do this.
I thought there was some of that subtext with, you know, just people listening to each other as opposed to using machines. I thought that was sort of, that was there in the background of your book.
Well, what I always say is Frankie's biggest superpower is she's a great listener. And that is a skill that is now just a lost art.
Mm-hmm. Sure is.
Lisa, are you a good listener? How much of Frankie are you in Frankie or Frankie is in you?
I think most novelists are. We absorb.
Yeah.
I mean, when I meet people, I want them to talk. I want their stories. I want to hear about their jobs. I'm always curious about jobs I didn't even know actually were jobs. Uh-huh. You know, novelists, we're a little bit like social parasites. We do want to know all about you. You read about it 3 to 5 years from now.
So you get book proposals from prisoners. You're becoming famous for this character and for looking for missing people. Do you have people contacting you saying, there's this case in such and such a state and we could really use your help? Are people reaching out to you for help?
Well, I mean, actually, there was one on Facebook just today. But to be honest, I mean, I'm still a novelist. Uh-huh. And some people are more, there's this case that needs more attention. You're a writer. Could you please write about it? But I'm not nonfiction. I'm not a journalist. I'm like, my imagination's too wild. I just, I don't think I could do it. But I do think we need to get more attention to many of these cases.
Yeah. How do we do that? Through wonderful books like yours. But do you think the law enforcement, do you think public officials in general, Judd, should be paying more attention to these kinds of things?
Well, we have some great organizations out there now, the Black and Missing Foundation. The internet, again, ground up is a great way of getting out information and gathering a certain level of momentum. That is one of the tools Frankie uses to find cases. Like, so what cold case is she going to work next? A lot of it comes from these forums.
Yeah.
I always love process. I love talking to people.
Writers can about ask a process question. I love
there
you, David.
You go. You're prolific at this. You're writing a book every year, which is insane. I don't know how you do that. As it's Tori knows, I'm just trying to start writing. I want to write one book. That'll be done. But if you write every year, that means that that you are very good at getting the thing finished. Whatever it is, I'm going to finish it. And then I'm going to concurrently start on the or finish the next one. And I've got 4 books in process. But writers, all of us have moments where it doesn't come out. It doesn't flow. I don't, there's no process to me. I tell people this all the time. When they say, how do you write? I go, I just start writing. That's all I do. There's nothing fancy. I just start writing until I'm done writing. But sometimes it's not there. And I just wonder what you do, because you've been doing this for so long now, to kind of get through that period when it's just not coming out the way it should.
Well, I have to admit, David, when you were talking about the Greco-Roman wrestling in the Olympics, my first thought was, you know, you're talking about 18 to 20 hours a day, covering whatever you're told to cover, trying to make it sound good, even if you know nothing at all. My first thought was you would make a great novelist. That's kind of the problem.
Yay!
There you go.
Thank you, Lisa. Thank
you, Lisa. Way more than you think. Yeah. You find the ways to get unstuck. Like, that's actually one of the reasons I hike. I mean, I've been a hiker my whole life, not just for writing One Step Too Far. I think they call it active meditation. I'm like you. I don't have a plan. I didn't even know we were going to have a second Frankie book. But once I start writing, when you get stuck, the blank computer screen's too much, get up, get moving. And for me, there's a connection with being outside. Some authors talk about going for a car ride. There's something about moving physically that gets your brain moving mentally. So it's a good trick to get unstuck.
Good call. Love it.
Very good call. Okay. How do you come up with lines like this? Short on belongings, long on regrets. Might be my favorite line in the book. Aww. And by the way, I listened to the book as well, which is fabulous. And I heard that. And whenever I was, again, I have almost wrecked my car a few times. I hear some great line, go, wait a minute, I want to hear that again. And trying to backpedal on it. But does that just come to you? Or do you work on the line for a while and then you massage it and make it better? Where does that come
from? Well, being candid, there's a lot of chocolate that goes into the creation of any of the dialogue in the lines in the novel.
See, David, another reason to write a book. Lots of chocolate. There you go. Right.
I love chocolate. Some Who things, doesn't like chocolate, though?
Some things flow and some things, I mean, there's days I write 5 pages and in the end you realize it was all this one sentence. Mm-hmm. And so the magic days that make you happy, your novelist, it comes out. And then there's plenty of other days where you feel like, you know, you're trying to squeeze blood from a stone and you just have to be patient. And then all of a sudden you read all of it, you wait, oh, it's this whole thing is a random thought that really just needs to be this.
Yeah.
Now and you don't get those 5 pages back. I mean, there's entire years of my life that I think are gone in a clip file at this point.
So in One Step Too Far, again, so many times I thought, okay, I've got this. I won't say it because I don't want to give anything away, but there was one person I said, it's that person. It wasn't. Do you know the ending when you sit there? So it evolves organically. That's incredible.
Yeah, what I like about not knowing the ending, when I first started out, I did need to plot because it was the only way I could have the confidence to sit down. Uh-huh. But I think as you get these more complicated thrillers, at least for me, part of it is not knowing because it forces you to be very balanced about your characters. Mm-hmm. We have a group of 8 going into the woods. Bad things very quickly start happening. They themselves know we should be looking at each other. So everyone needs to be believable and credible but everyone also has the potential for being evil or being the one doing dangerous things. So that complexity, and then really it's way at the very end of the book. Sometimes 2 weeks before deadline. And frankly, there's a lot of chocolate consumption going on. It's like, oh, I know what this actually is. And it's a relief each and every time.
The book was 98%. I was done with 98% of it. And I knew on some level what had happened and who it was, but I still didn't fully know until you later revealed it. You really, really do a great job of sort of unrolling the suspense slowly and making and building it. And it was just really well done.
Well, I like to joke, you can't know who did it because I didn't. So
I clearly didn't. And one thing I love is along the way, Judd, to your point, along the way, there were so many interesting scenes. There's so many interesting conversations, and it was so real. And I think there are so many different ways people can relate to the story. People may not care anything about Wyoming or they were never going to go hiking in their lives, but this was about people and their stories and their lives. It was fabulous. Okay, Lisa, let me get you out with this on the book and then we'll do 60 seconds more. What did you learn about yourself writing this book? Because I just have a gut feeling that you learn something about yourself every time you write a book.
But there's David,
another reason to write a book. So you learn something about yourself. But I have a gut feeling that maybe this one, because you're putting her in such a different place and different circumstances, that maybe it was something you're going through the pandemic, but I could be totally making this up. But what did you learn about yourself as you were writing this book about Frankie?
So The fun thing for me about writing, and particularly the Frankie books, is her discovery really becomes my discovery. Again, I don't have the answers to anything. I mean, I don't, it's not just that I don't know who did it. I'm never really sure what the book's really about, but there's always kind of a theme. There's an evolution. And for One Step Too Far, I think a lot of it is the nature of friendships and what happens when you don't get that closure. Something ends too abruptly, the fight that you never got to finish. How do you move on? How do you forgive? And I think that's something all of us are getting to think about a lot these days. Being empathetic, being a good listener, and how to forgive even when it's hard.
Nice. It's a great line. Okay, Lisa, the book is fabulous. It's One Step Too Far. Everyone should get it, hopefully at their independent bookstore. It's absolutely fabulous. We hope you come back. Whoever is next, whether it's Frankie or somebody else, we hope you come back and see us again. A little bit of housekeeping, then I'll let everybody go. So we are actually back next week, and we have, hold on, I have to reach for the book. I've heard about this book for a long time. Carrie Marr, and she has written The Paris Bookseller, which is about the woman who started the original Shakespeare and Company in Paris, which is no longer in existence, but an incredible story, an incredible book. So we have her back next week. Claude, thank you for making everything happen. Mayor Judd, stay well, my friend. Take care of everybody in Gaithersburg. Lisa, thank you so much. Great to see you. David, stay well. Get started on that book, and we'll talk to everybody soon. Thank you for listening.
Thank you all so very much. This is so much fun.
Thanks.
Thanks, Lisa.
We're out.
Guests on Chatter on Books are entitled to be entered into a raffle to win a home version of Chatter on Books, which includes a deck of laminated playing cards, a colorful game board, and an hourglass-style timer. And one entry per person in case of duplicate prizes, ties will be awarded. Must be present to win.